Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
And just in talking about the statistics and these this racial science, how this was used to promote, to justify white terrorism and abuse of black people. You talk during the Civil War where a lot of these notions that black males are defective and they're not really men, they're cowards, being challenged because you have lots of black males who are signing up and saying, hey, we want to fight. We want to fight for our freedom. Let us join the Union Army so we can go and fight against the Confederacy. That even while this is happening, you have all of these studies that are happening where black males who join the Union Army are being studied. And these studies, even though in the context, they are not necessarily setting out, per se, to do something to confirm that black males are defective and to support racism, but that's eventually how they end up being used. And just one quick passage. You write, one Mr. Russell, when accompanying the 25th Army Corps to the Texas boundary, was requested to avail himself of any opportunity which might occur to observe the colored troopers when unclothed and record their paucity on a scale from 0 to 10, with 10 representing the maximum which he had ever seen or should see in a white man. And they're talking about body hair for folks. He did so by observing the men while bathing. Russell was a busy man indeed and apparently had good eyesight. From his observation post near the bathing men, he recorded the relative paucity of 2,129 black or mixed race soldiers. One can only imagine what the black soldiers made of the good scientists spying on them in their nudity, writing furiously in his notebook as they bathed. Can you talk about these, how these statistics were used during the Civil War era for racist purposes, and then this incident specifically?
Yeah, you know, I can tell from your setup exactly what example you were going to use. That one just really blew my mind. And in part of it is because of the way that the logic of racism just constantly twists to serve new kind of historical and political contexts. So what he's actually, I mean, it sounds absurd, you know, that he's just spying on these men, trying to figure out how hairy they are. But what that actually is speaking to for him and for the other scientists is how manly they are. And this is right at this moment where the Civil War, I believe when he did that study, the Civil War had just ended. So the new debate among politicians, among kind of public intellectuals, among racial scientists is about what do we do with black people now, right? Now that they're no longer slaves, can they be men in the political sense of the word? And he's measuring something, that directly speaks to whether or not they are men in the bodily sense of the word. Like, are they manly enough compared to an assumed white body that he never even measures, right? He's not spying on white men. He's only looking at black men, and he's, you know, comparing them to this kind of imaginary white ideal. But he's looking to see if they're manly enough because that has all these political connotations directly after slavery is over. So the Civil War anthropometric studies that are published, they take on this new meaning. They're originally written in part, they're trying to answer this question of like, can black men be good soldiers? And overwhelmingly, a lot of these white scientists say, yeah, actually they make pretty good soldiers. But it's still an idea informed by racism at the time, because they say things like, you know, they're really good at, they're childlike and they listen to instruction. You know, they're good at marching. They're very strong of body, but, you know, they don't try to think too hard, you know, these kind of ideas. And that, you know, serves fairly well in the context of the question of should we let them serve in the army? But after the Civil War is over, what does that mean about whether or not they can be good citizens, fully engaged political citizens with the right to vote? You don't want somebody who's childlike and follows instructions and can't think for themselves. So that same data set is harnessed for a new racial context that becomes far more damning.
Isn't there, for people who have a really good memory, that scene should have evoked some Donald Sterling memories. If folks recall, before everything got to the recording and his housing discrimination suit, it came out that he had been spying on some of the players when he owned the Los Angeles Clippers team with mostly black males, that he was spying on them while they were in the locker room undressing and what have you, lusting over black bodies. But as I read that, not only did I have my Donald Sterling moment, I thought, wow, there's something really homoerotic about this. Yes?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, it seemed that way to me.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, November 15th, 2018. So I have been told this is our third study session on Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Knot, Race, Class, Genre, and Dilemmas of Black Manhood. We are in the very early stages of Chapter 1. Just really got into the meat of the book last week after we got through the introduction. In Chapter 1 this week of the text, the audio that you heard at the beginning, Melissa K. Stein. She was a guest on the broadcast back in 2016, leading up to the Trump election. White woman suspected racist. Dr. Curry recommended that we have her on the program. This was actually before The Man Knot was published. You will hear that very portion of her book, Measuring Manhood, that I read about the studies that whites were conducting on black Union soldiers during the Civil War. You will hear that referenced in this week's portion of The Man Knot. Even as I was doing the narration for this week, I saw quite a few folks, Cal's guests, who have been on in addition to Melissa K. Stein. Another reminder, we have been here for 10 years, the context of white supremacy. What have we been doing with our time and energy? Hopefully something constructive, but I will point out folks who have been on the program, because some of these folks, we talked about exactly the material that Dr. Curry is referencing in the book. The Cal's, once again, might be a nice study guide for this book as well, in addition to the number numerous times that Dr. Curry has been on the program. With that, we will go ahead and get started. Again, this is Dr. Tommy J. Curry's The Man Knot. We are in Chapter 1, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 1. Part of the family. The modality of the enslaved. In the 1830s, the domestication of American slavery marked a decisive shift from the previous century's idea of the natural slave unfit for liberty to the slave as the undeveloped savage in need of civilization and improvement. G.W.F. Hegel's commentary on the Negro and Africa actually serves as a grounding of the ethnology used in America regarding enslaved Africans. Hegel writes, in Negro life, the characteristic point is the fact that consciousness has not yet attained to the realization of any substantial objective existence, as, for example, God or law, in which the interest of man's volition is involved and in which he realizes his own being. Hegel believed that Africans had no notion of the other or a higher power outside their own existence. He thereby concludes that the Negro exhibits the natural man in his completely wild and untamed state, because the slave was thought to have no knowledge of his selfhood or the human soul. The Negro was thought to be completely sensual. For this race, human flesh is but an object of sense, mere flesh. It holds no meaning beyond perception. The sensual, savage Negro was trapped in the natural condition of being a stage of absolute and thorough injustice. The Negro was thought to have no spiritual or reflective consciousness of its existence, so slavery was a means of developing the Negro. Hegel is adamant that slavery is itself a phase of advance from the merely isolated sensual existence, a phase of education, a mode of becoming participant in a higher morality and the culture connected with it. While Hegel believed that slavery is in and for itself injustice, for the essence of humanity is freedom, the Negro is the exception, for this man must be matured. Hegel's depiction of the Negro was not the rambling of a simple racist posing as a philosopher. Hegel's lectures on the philosophy of world history spanned the years 1822 to 1831 and reflected the most authoritative ethnological thinking of the 19th century. These lectures overlapped Hegel's revisions to his Encyclopedia of Philosophical Sciences and conveyed what was considered the world's most advanced thinking as to the nature of the African. The description of the African as sensuous and not beyond the raw state of nature was not isolated to the colonial apologetics of Europeans. In the United States, the sensual nature of the Negro was used to justify the modernization of the American slave institution. Thomas Jefferson expressed a similar view in 1779 in his Notes on Virginia, saying of the Negro, in general, their existence appears to participate more of sensation than reflection. To this must be ascribed their disposition to sleep when abstracted from their diversions and unemployed in labor. An animal whose body is at rest and who does not reflect must be disposed to sleep, of course. Although Jefferson's statement was made in the second half of the 18th century, George Stroud's sketch of the law relating to slavery in 1856 showed that Jefferson's idea of the Negro was widely cited in support of American slavery within numerous states in the 19th century. The sensual nature of the slave, his lack of reflective capacities, required both order and education for his improvement. To remedy these defects in Negro character, American slavery underwent an evolution. As the historian Willie Lee Rose explains, in the 19th century, the phrase domestic institution came to mean slavery idealized. Slavery translated into a fundamental and idealized Victorian institution, the family. The domestication of slavery was not simply political. It introduced philosophical architecture or an order of man on the backs of enslaved African peoples. As Rose continues, pro-slavery philosophers intended to suggest a benign institution that encouraged between masters and slaves the qualities so much admired in the Victorian family. Cheerful obedience and gratitude on the part of children, read slaves, and paternalistic wisdom, protection, and discipline on the part of the father, read master. Whereas the 18th century justifications for slavery rested on the confinement of Africans to the realm of the non-human, 19th century laws restricting chattels' movement and eliminating their education indicate blacks were categorized as a special and different kind of humanity, as lesser humans in a dependency assumed to be perpetual. In earlier, harsher times, they had been seen as luckless, unfortunate barbarians. Now they were to be treated as children expected never to grow up. As the noted ethnologist John H. Van Every and pro-slavery propagandist explained, the great foundation principle, the subordination or slavery of this Negro element was universal and for 200 years and upwards unquestioned in a single instance on this continent or indeed any other, for like the relations of the sexes, of parents and children, etc., slavery was inherent, pre-existing, and sprung spontaneously from the necessities of human society. The white man was superior. The Negro was inferior. And in juxtaposition, society could only exist and can only exist by placing them in natural relation to each other or by the social subordination or so-called slavery of the Negro. The Negro's moral cultivation depended on the advances of the white civilization according to 19th century ethnologists. Slavery was merely an expression of the universal racial order that was based on not only scientific theories of racial inferiority, but also the belief that the organization of the state and broader society should be modeled on the patriarchal hierarchy of the family. This history adds to Angela Davis's claim that if black women were hardly women in the accepted sense, the slave system also discouraged male supremacy in black men. Given the absolute power of the slave master, Davis is correct that the promotion of male supremacy among the slaves might have prompted a dangerous rupture in the chain of command. But even more threatening was that black manhood, if achieved within the institution of slavery, threatened the very chain of being established on the Victorian family model. Slavery absolutely denied blacks a gender. They were beasts of burden. As Rose writes, while the plantation community was a patriarchy and the planter's family a matriarchy, the domesticity in the enslaved cabin at the quarters was, ironically, about as close an approximation to equality of the sexes as the 19th century provided. Because of slavery, an androgynous world was born, weirdly enough, not of freedom, but bondage. The African was labor, the corporalization of blackness. It was not afforded the distinctions founded on white bodies, nor was it delineated by gender as masculine or feminine. The order of American slavery established on the domestic realm of the family was thought to be at the foundation of America as a nation and, as illustrated shortly, as an empire. As C.G. Memminger noted in 1851, in the Hebrew polity, we have the family as the basis and origin of all government. The individual is only known as one of a family. His duties and rights are measured by his position there. If he is the father, he commands. If the son, he obeys. In the one case, he provides and gives. In the other, he takes and receives. Inequality and dependence prevail throughout. all benefit or all suffer from the good or evil of each. A few moments' reflection will show that Southern society, in common with that of the most stable governments known to history, rests upon the family or Hebrew basis. The slave institution at the South increases the tendency to dignify the family. Each planter is, in fact, a patriarch. His position compels him to be a ruler in his household. From early youth, his children and servants look up to him as the head, and obedience and subordination become important elements of education. Where so many depend upon one will, society necessarily assumes the Hebrew form. Domestic relations become those which are most prized. Each family recognizes its duty, and its members feel a responsibility for its discharge. The fifth commandment becomes the foundation of society. The state is looked to only as the ultimate head in external relations, while all internal duties, such as support, education, and the relative duties of individuals, are left to domestic regulation. In our post-structuralist moment, patriarchy would seem obviously to resonate with Memminger's account. There is a white male father who orders and controls enslaved Africans who are thought to be children, and this is the basis of both government and nation. The intuitive, ahistorical, critical reaction is far too deterministic to be useful in our attempts to grasp the reality of Memminger's claim. The domestication of slavery was not solely determined by white male power. The institution itself gave rise to different spheres of influence. Africans needed not only to be controlled, but also to be improved and educated. The white father enforced law and order, but it is the white imperial mother who dictated societal morality and education. These modalities introduced patriarchy as the platform from which the civilizing power of the white woman was displayed. This account offers a much-needed complexity to the presumed asymmetrical relations between white men and women and the enslaved. Beyond mere politics or identity, the position of whites within slavery was indicative of established orders of being endemic to the institution. Enslaved Africans were oppressed by both white men and white women. Different qualities were thought to be advanced by their servitude to each. Contrary to the presumed passivity of the white woman, where her day-to-day abuses of slaves is denied and thought to have been violence committed only by white men, the white woman was charged with the managing and punishing of slaves as she saw fit. While the home was certainly ordered toward patriarchy in which white men expected to be obeyed by women, children, and slaves, the white woman showed unusual power within that domain. Because she reared children, the white woman was thought to set the standards for behavior. In the South, this power over the moral realm motivated white womanhood to differentiate itself from manhood. It was an ideal she sought diligently to live up to the prescriptions. As an English visitor remarked concerning the order of a slave owner's North Carolina home, the legislative and executive powers of the house belong to the mistress. The master has nothing to do with administration. He is a monument of uxoriousness and passive endurance. The power of administration was the white woman's primary relationship to slaves. As the historian Anne Fuhrer Scott writes, the mistress had to dispense justice, settle small personal feuds, and cajole those who did not want to work. Despite her erasure, the Southern white woman's work was to extend the order of the home beyond its physical architecture and into the world. The plantation was just the frontier it most immediately bordered. In 1853, Horace Mann, the famous anti-slave education reformer, wrote that the charge of woman is the empire of home. That most important of empires and the parent of all empires and emperors. The academic construct of woman is ontologically set against that of man. By effect, theorists assert this a priori opposition as an analogous rationale to assert that the rise of woman, her rights, writings, and criticisms of society throughout the mid-1800s was, in fact, set against patriarchy. The historical record shows that feminism encouraged rather than opposed white male rule. The historian Mary P. Ryan argues the 1850s saw two icons, the isolated home and the imperial mother, installed at the center of popular discourse. On the one hand, the idea of woman's moral superiority inherent in her characterization as pure, loving, and protected from the temptations of the world was thought to define the home, which was isolated from the industrial and violent white male world of politics and served as the foundation of her feminism. On the other, the moral power of women was transported in one great mythical leap from the fireside circle to the vast expanses of national life, from family to society, from isolated home to mother's empire. Conceptually, imperial isolation is a contradiction of terms, but it formed the sociological basis of both the political isolation and the political power the white woman was given throughout the 1800s. The moral and civilizational superiority of the white woman served as the basis from which white women asserted their right as women over and against those of savages, particularly racialized and savage men. As Ryan writes, glorifying the female in her home confinement precluded a feminist critique of gender asymmetry. Because the moral superiority of the white woman over the white man was rooted in her isolation from the world. Although Ryan never connects the empire of the mother to the growing empire of the United States, her text attempts to push against the historical narration of women as simply repressed and misled by domesticity. As she writes, with motherhood as its symbolic crown and the home the functional center of their empire, women did, in fact, command a critical social position. The literary scholar Amy Kaplan's article, Manifest Domesticity, is critical of Ryan's inability to see how the rise of white motherhood within the isolated home was used as a metric to establish the barbarism of foreign, alien, racialized people and justify colonialism. Kaplan claims that Ryan's Empire of the Mother employs empire as a metaphor framing her analysis, yet she never links this pervasive imperial metaphor to the contemporaneous geopolitical movement of imperial expansion or to the discourse of manifest destiny. Kaplan maintains that Ryan's blind spot stems from the way that the ideology of separate spheres has shaped scholarship. Until recently, it has been assumed that nationalism and foreign policy lay outside the concern and participation of women. The term domestic has a double meaning that not only links the familial household to the nation, but also imagines both in opposition to everything outside the geographic and conceptual border of the home. The white mother, her empire, begins in the home, but takes that which is outside of the home as the racialized other, the uncivilized world that needs a modernization and improvement. This historical inclination of patriarchy toward territorial expansion and manifest destiny has also been well documented by Amy Greensburg, but for her it is primarily male dominance, masculinity's nationalist fervor that implicates womanhood. While Greensburg showed that westward expansion proved that domesticity and manifest destiny could be mutually reinforcing, womanhood is imagined to be culpable only for erroneously believing in the ideas of imperialism, not acting on them, since most white women were thought to be confined to the home. In Ryan's view, the home is isolated from the industrial and political impetus of manifest destiny and colonial imperialism. Those motivations belong to the character of white masculinity. Kaplan maintains that Ryan's view of the home breaks down when domesticity is interrogated not as mutually reinforcing, but as mutually constituting Western empire. Kaplan argues that domesticity can be viewed as an anchor, a feminine counterforce to the male activity of territorial conquest. In this sense, white womanhood was a source of the colonial logics that made that which is outside the home foreign, and that which is foreign a threat to all that was domestic. There was power in the empire of the home that cannot be adequately captured within the popular historical narration of the home as oppressive and the white woman's position as comparable to that of the black slave. Throughout the mid-19th century, white women enthusiastically embraced what Kaplan calls imperial domesticity. These women understood that by withdrawing from direct agency in the male arena of commerce and politics, woman's sphere can be represented by both women and men as a more potent agent for national expansion. The modalities asserted within the domestic sphere, the order of white man, woman, and child, operated as a metric to judge the racialized other as uncivilized and thereby able to be subjugated, rather than domesticity operating as the limit of white womanhood. Kaplan shows the outward reach of domesticity enables the interior functioning of the home. The white home of the 1860s forward not only was used to gauge the civilization of all other races, but also was necessary to the settler project itself. As the historian Margaret Jacobs explains, the home was an essential means of establishing dominance in the new settlement. Settler colonies thus relied on the mobilization of white women, who were charged with making and keeping the home as key figures in promoting settlement. According to white women's rights activists of the time, this made white women indispensable to the West's civilizing missions abroad. Those who can be colonized. Ethnology as the foundation of black sensuality and the black male rapist. The chain of being established on the white family was not isolated to the political economy of the 19th century American slavery. It was, in fact, scientific and the cornerstone of modern ethnology. The American Ethnological Society was founded in 1842, only months apart from the Ethnological Society of London. But modern ethnology, whose approaches had benefited from Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species after 1859, is distinguished from these earlier incarnations in its use of evolution to explain the divergences among races. A. H. Keane's Ethnology, Fundamental Ethical Problems, the Primary ethnical groups, claims that ethnology proceeded through a comparative method of racial groups to determine the absolute and relative value of racial criteria, miscegenation, the origin and evolution of articulate speech, and its value as a test of race, the influence of the environment on the evolution of human varieties, on their pursuits, temperament, religious views, grades of culture, the evolution of the family, clan, tribe, and nation. The 19th century psychologist, historian, and philosopher Wilhelm Dilthey, who also held Hegel's chair of philosophy at the University of Berlin, wrote that ethnology describes the natural articulation of the human race and the resulting distribution of human life over the face of the earth in light of its physical characteristics. This ethnology thus investigates how the human race, on the basis of family ties and kinship, is naturally grouped into concentric spheres measured by degree of kinship, i.e., how in each narrower sphere, along with closer ties, new common characteristics appear. Because ethnology focused on the relations races shared, racial contact was explained within white gender hierarchies ordered to a familiar hierarchy led by the patriarch. Arthur de Gobineau's The Inequality of the Human Races, 1854, is an instructive example of this hierarchy in practice. While his text is considered one of the most illustrious racist political treatises of the 19th century, it is useful to remember that it appeared during the same decade as the discourse of imperial domesticity and reflected the order imposed on the African as savage but childlike and feminine. Gobineau believed that every human activity, moral or intellectual, has its original source in one or the other of these two currents, male or female. And only the races which have one of these elements in abundance, without, of course, being quite destitute of the other, can reach in their social life a satisfactory stage of culture and so attain to civilization. Civilization is founded on the masculine or feminine principle operating to build a republic. Gobineau insisted that institutions invented and molded by a race of men make the race what it is. They are effects, not causes. Unlike our 21st century theories of social constructionism, Gobineau held that the creations of our society emanate from the inner personality and substance of races. The male nations look principally for material well-being. The female nations are more taken up with the needs of the imagination. The superiority of the German stock is birthed from the generational accumulation of blood from male races, while degenerate European races of the South are accepting more feminine blood. This is the foundation from which philosophy and poetry, language and literature grow. The mark of races, male and female principle, is so remarkable that Gobineau actually argues, if a degraded people at the lowest rung of the racial ladder, with as little significance for the male as for the female progress of mankind, could possibly have invented a language of philosophic depth, of aesthetic beauty and flexibility, rich in characteristic forms and precise idioms, fitted alike to express the sublimities of religion, the graces of poetry, the accuracy of physical and political science, such a people would certainly possess an utterly useless talent, that of inventing and perfecting an instrument which their mental capacity would be too weak to turn to any account. Following the ethnological order that establishes Africans as ungendered, Gobineau made the lack of civilization synonymous with the temperament of the race. Because savage races lacked the distinctions of gender, Africans could not appreciate the creations that are birthed from the gendered temperaments of the masculine and feminine, such as truth, God, and poetry. As with concomitant logic of the patriarchal home, the patriarchal race was ordered such that white men and women could civilize and improve the savage races. As Jules Michelet writes, Africa is woman. Her races are feminine. The designation of a race as feminine was not to suggest that the feminine race was, in fact, gendered, but that the feminine race held an inferior relation to the patriarchal Anglo-Saxon race and possessed a sensual constitution. They were feminine because they were to be ruled by the masculine race of white men and women. Ethnological theory created a stark divide between the black race and the white race. Because all black people are of the feminine savage races, black men and women could not partake in the same genders of a dominant masculine race. The 19th century ideas of race and gender, if such a term can even apply to Africans, were the result of complete differences in the kinds of evolutionary species between racial groups. Evolution meant that every race would have different gendered kinds within its group. If it developed to actually grasp civilization, non-white, savage, primitive groups were denied altogether the specific race-gender distinctions that whites had because such distinctions were specific to the exclusive mark of the civilized white races. In this sense, there were no categories or universals that captured the shared historical experiences between these groups. Commenting on the 19th century sexual delineations within racial taxonomies in Imperial Leather, Race, Gender, and Sexuality in the Colonial Contest, Anne McClintock argues racial stigmata were systematically, if often contradictorily, drawn on to elaborate minute shadings of difference in which social hierarchies of race, class, and gender overlapped each other in a three-dimensional graph of comparison. The rhetoric of race was used to invent distinctions between what we would now call classes. At the same time, the rhetoric of gender was used to make increasingly refined distinctions among the different races. The white race was figured as the male of the species and the black race as the female. Similarly, the rhetoric of class was used to inscribe minute and subtle distinctions between other races. The Zulu male was regarded as the gentleman of the black race, but was seen to display features typical of females of the white race. While this may seem contradictory to our 21st century ideas, it is crucial to understand the differences between 19th century ethnology and the schemas of our present day. According to the European ethnologies that served as the basis of the 19th century account of race, gender simply did not exist within the Negro race. Blacks were primitive and, as such, had not yet evolved to the level of civilization necessary to warrant distinctions between men and women. As purely sensual beings, they had no reflective sensibilities that could grasp the purpose of gender roles, which was to ground civilization, much less the morality of femininity or burdens of masculinity, according to 19th century racial sciences. Ethnological science had a peculiar effect on studies of black males. Consistent with McClintock's historical schema, 19th century ethnologists categorized the Negro male as the racial instantiation of what was known in the white race as female. For example, Franz I. Pruner Bay suggested that the black man is to white man what woman is to man in general, a loving being and being of pleasure, while Karl Vaught held that the grown-up Negro partakes as regards his intellectual faculties of the nature of the female child and the senile white. He manifests a propensity for pleasure, music, dancing, physical enjoyments, and conversations, while his inconstancy of impressions and of all the feelings are those of a child. Despite the alleged lack of reflective capacity and the notable feminine character of black males, ethnologists interpreted the sensuality of the black male as uncontrollable, insatiable, and dangerous. In other words, the supposed childlike mentality of black males did not stop ethnologists from developing scientific theories that inevitably would claim that black males were biologically predisposed to rape. During the U.S. Civil War, black male savageness and pre-rationality were so solidified within the mind of the 19th century ethnologist that black soldiers were studied in the nude to ascertain their masculine attributes. As the historian Melissa Stein explains, secondary sex characteristics like body and facial hair were of keen interest to white scientists during and after the Civil War. Van Every explained the intellect, the mental strength, the moral beauty, all the qualities of the inner beings, as well as those outward attributes tangible to the sense, harmonize perfectly with the growth of the beard, and when that has reached its full development, it is both the signal and the proof of mature manhood. Van Every claimed that the Caucasian was the only bearded race, and the male beard symbolizes our highest conception of manhood. It is the outward evidence of mature development, of complete growth, mental as well as physical, of strength, wisdom, and manly grace. Because the Negro male had very little facial hair, except a little tuft on the chin and sometimes on the upper lip, he did not exhibit the physiological characteristics of manhood and, by effect, was disqualified from social manhood rights and citizenship. The Union was so firmly committed to these markers of manhood that in 1863 it commissioned the Sanitary Commission to measure the most important physical dimensions and personal characteristics of the diverse male bodies to whom their work afforded access. Physicians were to observe the colored troopers when unclothed and record their pilosity on a scale from 1 to 10, with 10 representing the maximum which he had ever seen or should see in a white man. After the Civil War, ethnological theories arguing for the natural defect in black males proliferated. With the end of slavery, many scientists argued the black male's innate inclination to rape was freed. As the sexologist G. Frank Lydston claimed, when all inhibitions of a high order have been removed by sexual excitement, I fail to see any difference from a physical standpoint between the sexual furor of the Negro and that which prevails among the lower animals in certain instances and at certain periods. James Kiernan, in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Diseases in 1885, called attention to a fact which is very pertinent to our present inquiry, namely, that the furor sexualis in the Negro resembles similar sexual attacks in the bull and elephant and the running amok of the Malay race. This furor sexualis has been especially frequent among the Negroes in states cursed by carpetbag statesmanship, in which frequent changes in the social and commercial status of the Negro race have occurred. While enslaved, the Negro was subjugated by the law and the punishment of the whip. According to the Texan physician F. E. Daniel, during slavery, there was no perversion of the sexual sense. The males did not desire the white woman nor dream of ravishing the white children. Freed from these restraints, and despite torture and certain death staring him in the face, the rape fiend, the Negro sadist, wreaks his vengeance and spite on some innocent child and gratifies, in that unnatural manner, his abominable lust. Slavery, instead of being justified as a political institution, was the juridical containment of black male savagery, a condition under freedom that would lead to the ravishing of white women and the moral regression of the black race. During the late 1800s, the sexuality of black males became the dominant social problem of the post-slave society. The sensual nature attributed to blacks depicted the whole race as irrational and childlike, but it peculiarly made the black male a sexual deviant and aggressor. This was his nature. The onset of puberty regressed the Negro male's intellect and empowered his primal sexual lust. According to the turn-of-the-century physician William Lee Howard, it is a fact observed by those who are in a position to study the Negro that with the advent of puberty, all intellectual development ceases. Even the sound memory, which is the cause of much apparent precociousness, seems to be submerged by the growth and activity of sensuality. With the advent of puberty, the Negro shows his genetic instincts to be the controlling factor of his life. These take hold of his religion, control his thoughts, and govern his actions. In the increase of rape on white women, we see the explosion of a long train of antecedent preparation. The attacks on defenseless white women are evidences of racial instincts that are about as amenable to ethical culture as is the inherent odor of the race. It is this sexual question that is the barrier which keeps the philanthropist and moralist from realizing that the phylogenies of the Caucasian and African races are divergent, almost antithetical, and that it is gross folly to attempt to educate both on the same basis. When the education will reduce the large size of the Negro's penis as well as bring about the sensitivities of the terminal fibers which exist in the Caucasian, then will it also be able to prevent the African's birthright to sexual madness and excess from the Caucasian's viewpoint. The size of his black penis indicated to ethnologists that the Negro was ruled by that appendage, unaffected by religion, morality, or reason. Because progressive methods were thought to be incompatible with his nature, his savagery was often characterized as a medical disorder in need of punitive surgical procedures such as castration. The sexual insatiability of the black male was established as scientific fact, and rape became married to his character. By the turn of the century, social Darwinism had made a lasting impact on the ethnological considerations of race across the world. Because the African male was thought to be irrational and barbarous, he was not a patriarch and therefore unfit to rule or govern himself. The black male was thought of as that thing that is to be ruled. He could not be improved through education or religion because his sexual instincts were overwhelmed by the higher faculties to which ethics or reason would appeal. Whereas the white male was rational and ordered, the African male was sensual and violent and in need of a patriarchal ruler to make him obey the laws of civilization. In the 19th century, the black male was thought to be a threat not only to white women, but to all women, black as well as white. Colonialism was often justified as an effort to save the savage women from their brute males. As Lewis Newman writes, for over a century, Westerners had presumed that primitive women were overworked, sexually abused, or otherwise badly treated by men of their cultures. Like Newman, Gail Betterman argues that savage, that is, non-white, races had not yet evolved pronounced sexual differences, and to some extent, this was precisely what made them savage. Savage men had never evolved the chivalrous instinct to protect their women and children, but instead forced their women into exhausting drudgery, cultivating the fields, tending the fires, carrying heavy burdens. Overworked savage women had never evolved the refined delicacy of civilized women. Judging from this model of the home founded on patriarchy's projection of the empire of the mother, most social Darwinists located primitive societies at an earlier stage of development than civilized societies and often measured a society's relative position in the hierarchy of primitive to civilized nations by woman's status or condition. The black African male was identified as an abuser of the primitive woman, and colonialism was rationalized as an attempt to save her from her savage male counterpart. Within the evolutionary schemas of ethnology, the distinctions within racial groups constituted differences in kind. One could be rank and file, or upper class, but these were fundamental evolutionary distinctions among blacks, not labels taken on as indicative of the shared conditions of individuals within the race or across different races. Blacks and other savage races could not be compared with whites on the basis of presumed universal categories such as masculinity and femininity. They could only be recapitulated, to paraphrase the work of Granville Stanley Hall. Recapitulation theory claimed that evolved races pass through the stages of primitism as they mature from childhood to adulthood. Ontogeny prevented the primitive races from possessing the qualities of the civilized race. Within this account, a physiologically mature adult male would be thought of as the moral and intellectual equivalent of a white child. Because the racial designations were always inferior, it was thought that the ontogeny of the white race could serve as the scale of the development for the inferior races. Our present-day understandings simply reduce these ethnological distinctions and evolutionary beliefs to political beliefs and erroneous racist ideology, where in reality these were scientific doctrines accepted by both black and white thinkers and produced any number of positions about race, manhood, womanhood, and racial uplift. In the 19th century terms, the black race was savage and did not have genders. There were sexual differences between males and females within the Negro race, but in relation to the white race, the Negro was feminine. The only evolutionary distinction that mattered between black males and females emerged after puberty, whereby the feminine black female was transformed into the black male rapist, and this transformation was especially relevant for white women's rights activists. Context of white supremacy. We will pick up second audio segment, The Sexual Inversion, The Primal Rapist as Feminism's Foundational Ethnology. That's the subsection of chapter one that we will begin for the second audio segment. Until then, the number to dial if you have thoughts, questions that you would like to share, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. We will get to folks who dialed in with a hand up shortly. I will say, we had a listener who was discussing the book, and they thought it was important that we are reading this year book on the cows. I do too. But one of the things that they said, I think it's great because there might be a number of listeners who maybe they wouldn't necessarily read this book on their own. They maybe wouldn't have time, wouldn't go to the library, wouldn't purchase it, or just wouldn't have access to read the text. But maybe they would take time to listen to it. At least now that is an option, that there is an audio book for The Man Knot. I said, absolutely. Glad that we can help produce that. And as I said last week, man, I really wish the great Joe Morton, that we could get him to read The Man Knot as he did for Invisible Man. Wow. Oh, well. Glad to have the audio segment and the contributions from all of the listeners as well. Question for folks who are dialing in or listening, if you would like to not be a spectator. The segment in the text, I have to pull up my notes really quick. This just pertains to one of the final, let's see. Yes, here we go. I'm not going to give out the page number because I have the ebook, but it's right towards the end of the subsection that we just finished in chapter one. It says the black African male was identified as an abuser of the primitive woman, and colonialism was rationalized as an attempt to save her from her savage male counterpart. Right? That's the sentence. The question, do we see that same strategy being used now, 2018, by racists, that the black female needs to be saved. Whites, we need to intervene to save the black female from the no good, feverish, barbarous black male. question. And then just based on what we've heard this week and through the first, I guess, 3 weeks now of the man knot, do we have a better understanding for why Mr. Fuller suggests that we not refer to black males and females as men and women, particularly given what we just read this week? Those are the two questions. Folks can respond to those, or if you have your own thoughts, questions about the text. And again, Dr. Curry is aware that we are reading his work. So if you have questions, if things didn't make sense, terms, anything, feel free. We can write them down and get Dr. Curry to explain. I'm sure he would be happy to do so. So be mindful of that as we proceed. First few folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to the callers, listeners, and thank you guys again for the platform. I know you stated you definitely would be good to have I forgot the gentleman's name you mentioned reading the book, but you're doing a pretty good job so far. I'm able to follow, and some of these words are very difficult, and I have to admit, one of them I'd like to get to right now is ethnology. It's actually one of the first times I've ever looked up the meaning for this word. I had no idea. And I looked it up online, and just one moment. Just got to get back to that. The study of the characteristics of various peoples and differences and relationships between them. But even from here, and this goes to your question, it seems like even from the beginning, the very beginning of their study of us as a so-called people, non-white, they've already had it stapled in their mind as non-gender. Henceforth, Nellie Fuller's position and statement in regards to not relating to us and other non-white people as men and women is accurate. It's very accurate. And you could see that this goes back, we're talking 1800s, some of these so-called professors are bringing this to light about their opinion of us from a very, very early stage. And it stands out. And this is something that I thought that was interesting, especially even out in Berlin, Germany, everywhere. The other question you had, I believe, was in regards to the actual methods that they're using still to this day to divide us. I think it's very obvious that that is being done still, and on a large scale. And I think in the past it may have been done with women's suffrage, where, you know, they literally went to black women and explained that if their men became free, that it would be a problem. And also, you know, during the 60s with Section 8, where you're allowed to have, where a black woman could have a home and her children can stay there and get all these benefits, but they're not allowed to have a male in the household, which I just think is crippling to the household at the end of the day. And they're fully aware of that based on the research that we could see just from this book right now. The other thing I wanted to bring to forth was, there was a passage. Here it is. It's on page 50. I have the book, and it states in the middle, it goes, because savage races lack the distinctions of gender, Africans could not appreciate the creations that are birthed from the gendered temperaments of masculine and feminine, such as truth, God, and poetry. And it goes on as the continent, I'm not pronouncing that properly, logic of the patriarchal home and the patriarchal race was ordered such that white men and women could civilize and improve the savage races. And this goes to the white man's burden. Like, you could see how that concept was birthed off of their studies, so-called studies of us, where they felt that this, after doing all this research and studying us as a people, that we need to be governed, we need to be ruled over, such as the way that they saw benefit. Also, something that stands out very big, and I don't want to take up too much time, I want to hear other people as well, but during the Civil War, and this passage over here, this is page 52 at the top, where they were speaking about facial features. And I think it's, I mean, right now, the fact that bearded, like almost everywhere you go, I'm in New York City, bearded men is just a thing right now. And I wondered why that fashion kicked in. And then I'm reading this passage where Van Irvin claimed that the Caucasian was the only bearded race, and the male beard symbolizes our highest conception of manhood. It is the outward evidence of mature development, of complete growth, mental as well as physical, of strength and physical wisdom, strength, wisdom, and manly grace. And I think that stands so, it also deals with the other aspect of Nellie Fuller, where Nellie Fuller mentions that, you know, a man is not somebody with a whole bunch of muscles walking around big and brawly. That's not a man. And I think that could be taken in the same context right here with this beard idea. And I think that a lot of non-white males have this blurred perception in their mind that is a standout of their masculinity. It means that they're men at that point. But I think it was really interesting how that passage even connects to this day, to this time, much like almost everything in here. That being said, I will mute my line. Thank you for listening to me. Peace.
Thank you for sharing, sir. And I will encourage folks to follow your example. Have your dictionary at hand while reading this text. I've said that for some of the other books that we've read, including Yorugu. I think that was mentioned last week, the ISIS papers, even though we have not done that in the book club. But I think you will get more out of the book. Just have you, and with any text, anytime that you're reading a book or doing any reading and you come across a word that you are not familiar with, go ahead and look it up. That is the correct way. We are all still learning. Others that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the other callers. Listeners, I was late tuning in because my book was slow getting in. And this book is one that is of such, like you said, it's better to actually have the text in front of you because it's complex, to say the least. But one of the things that struck me was being a black male, when you think about you're growing up a young black male, trying to obtain masculinity, and it's impossible because of the society is denying it to you. That in itself could cause a tremendous dilemma inside the mind of a young black male. But then the author is going even deeper than that. Back, if you go, I used to wonder why Mr. Nellie Fuller would always use the plantation as an example. But if you go all the way back to the antebellum era, and you see the way it was set up, the white slave owner as the patriarch, and the role of the white woman, I think the book led that she was like the in charge of the empire of the home, and that the home was viewed as the inner workings, and everything outside of that was then the other. So then And he also brought up the fact that when women suffering, when the women activists were pursuing their rights to white women, it wasn't so much as for the vote of the black male as it was for them to solidify their status as being superior also to the black male. You see, it's never any confusion with white people on being superior, feeling or trying to exude a feeling of superiority over the other. That's why it's necessary that they create the other. And like one of your questions was, is it true today that this division, you know, creating a reality that black women have to be saved from the black male savage? And the savagery of the black male and the black male as a rapist is relevant to white women's rights advocates, because you have to have this symbol in order to justify all these pathological beliefs. And one part of the book, I can't remember which part, but it's talking about the necessity of the white woman in settling of the West. And then my mind quickly went to the fact that on all the Westerns that you see, when they were going in to settle some of these parts, the white women was necessary. They bring them in to set up the, I think the book said about missions, but what about the brothels? They came in to set up that too. That was necessary for that type of endeavor. And I just think the book is very insightful into the fact that it's tying in the sexual impulses of the dominant class of people that look at black males and black females in sexual manner. The racism is closely tied in with sexual dominance. And I believe that we can see that in the book. And just like the last caller brought up the fact of the beard symbolizing a concept of manhood, I think that you can see that today in a lot of these white supremacy groups. The males grow these long beards, and on almost all of the so-called white nationalists, the beards seem to be a symbol of some type of patriotic image or some type of manhood type image. But I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Others,
can I be heard?
Thomas in New York. Yes, sir.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all the callers. Gus, it's we're having an apocalypse here in New York. It's nothing but a sheet of ice everywhere. So it took me, I almost broke my neck a few minutes ago. He did a great job proving white women are portrayed as the moral authority within the system of white supremacy, how they promote that theory. And I believe we buy into it, because anytime I would mention anything about white women in particular, black people get very defensive of that. It's like, you know, you could say, you know, things about white men, but they defend the white woman. And I think that he did a great job of pointing out how that whole thing plays out. The beard situation is something I witnessed in high school. amongst the whites. We had, you know, it was pretty interesting because they would not let black people have a beard. They would make us cut our little goatees. That we couldn't even have a mustache, but they didn't enforce that on the white kids until when I went to the school. And our parents complained that we were getting hair bumps, and they made it so both people. But I think the beard replaced their complex of not having a larger penis, which is why. And of course, you know, I think that that's a huge part of why they would mutilate the genitalia of people when they lynched them, and you know, keep them as souvenirs. Things of that nature. I think that's a complex they have. I believe that he did a great job with that. The Darwinism concept, and you know, he didn't mention him, but his cousin Thomas Huxley combined and expounded upon by others who came after them, is the logic, a huge part, at least 50% of the logic that the system of white supremacy works on. I think he did an excellent job of pointing that out, because a lot of people don't do that. And my critique is still the same. I still think that it's not written for black people, but I think he's doing an excellent job, and I mute my line. Oh, Gus, to your question, I do see them doing that today. The white woman, the black woman being saved by the white man or the white people from the savage black man. I do see them doing that today. I think that's a huge part of feminism, in particular amongst blacks, black women. You don't need that man. You know, he's not no good anyway. You know, that those concepts are all coming from, I believe, that whole premise. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Be safe, Thomas in New York. One reason right there. No fan of New York. Ick. No fan of winter weather in general. Man, stay safe. Others who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary and we've not heard from you, proceed.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, I'm sure they don't have any ice storms down in South Florida.
It is approximately 81 degrees, and it's been that way just about every day this year so far. Although it's supposed to get during the daytime in the 60s, but it would get to the 80s very quickly within the afternoon. A weather that I am used to and appreciate. You asked a question about what was it with black females and males as far as white supremacists is concerned?
The one question was, given what Dr. Curry wrote for this week's portion, do we have a better understanding of why Mr. Fuller recommends not using the terms men and women for black people? And then the other question was, Dr. Curry had a passage where he talked about in the 19th century, they would say that savage, non-white females needed to be saved by colonizers, racists. They needed to be saved from the abusive, savage, non-white male. And I asked if people see examples of that same concept being put forward today, that black females need to be saved by whites from abusive, savage, raping black males.
Yes, sir. I identify that with the strategy that the races have been applying for centuries, because it assists them to maintain the system of racist white supremacy. If non-white black people in their confused state would do a lot of their work physically through their confusion, if I'm making sense to the listeners. It's a actually it's like a military strategy to create a global atmosphere to whereas the victims would actually fight and fuss and kill each other, male on male, and of course male with female. I think by nature itself, females and males is designed for us to, by nature, to be close. And in turn, but the environment has to be productive. Certainly in a global system of racist white supremacy, there is no productivity, especially amongst the people who are not considered to be white. And so it's a strategy. It's a strategy, and so far it's been, unfortunately, it's been successful. I talked so much on that one. I forgot the first. Oh, men and women. It's just a logical thought that however one defines the terms men and women, it cannot exist if you are a victim of racism, white supremacy at the same time. That is two titles which non-white people, especially non-white black people, are going to have to redefine. Once we solve this problem, replace it with a system of justice. Mr. Fuller uses the term universal man and universal woman as the top titles of achievement. There was something else that you were mentioning, but I would just mention before I forget on what thought kept running through my mind through the first half was with the talk that that Mr. Curry was speaking about with the different examples he mentioned about mentioning as such as the black non-white black people considered to be feminine as opposed to masculinity. I think a lot of the listeners just recently have heard that, and this is done by white people, I'm assuming. I do know it's a black male actor just recently been titled the sexiest man alive. I don't know his name. I only thing I know about him, he is an actor. I've seen him in movies every now and then, but I can't remember his name. And I think that has some that just is ringing in my head from listening to the first report and how that contrast. Yes. It's a name that you don't often hear, but I'm pretty sure that's the person's name. And I'm just thinking about how that connects to the first half of the reading, which is not the first time that a black male or black males have been given such titles. I don't know what to make out of that exactly. I'm not thrilled by it. That's the first thing I would say. I think Jim Brown, in his younger years, was also accepted in that way that white males wished they were him, you know, things of that nature. And I'm pretty sure several other black males who are like that also. But under the system of racist white supremacy, black males are going to be, it has to be, in order for that to be a reality, have to be demonized and subjected in so many different unfavorable ways that's a must in order for such a thing to exist as the global system of racism and white supremacy. And that's all I have to say for this particular half of the reading.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I know for Idris Elba, black male, alleged sexiest man alive. I think for the photograph that I've seen for that image, he does have a beard, if that relates to the text that we covered. And in my view, if it is a black male or a black female with that title, sexiest person alive, that just means that you are a extra delectable Negro. Let's see. If you have commentary, you should go ahead and get a hand up. Don't lollygag because the second segment is a little lengthier. So make sure that we cover that adequately. I'll share my thoughts and then we'll get to it. We'll make sure we should have a few minutes if folks have other comments, but we are going to get to the second audio segment a little bit earlier just to make sure. Some of the things that I made note of, I thought it was really important. I think, as Thomas said, that's, I hope anybody, this is 10 years of the context of white supremacy. I hope that that is one thing we've emphasized over the last decade, that the system of white supremacy cannot operate, does not operate, will not operate without racist woman, racist man, racist child. You cannot have a system where people are talking about white women are treated just like niggers and that sort of nonsense, which is dangerous because you have a lot of victims who get confused about that, as Thomas was talking about. But white women are integral in the system of racism, white supremacy, where he writes, Kaplan argues that domesticity can be viewed as an anchor, a feminine counterforce to the male activity of territorial conquest, their role, white women's role in the house. We've talked about that so many times over the years, that is a foundation of how you have the next generation of, you know, racist man, racist woman to continue dominating and terrorizing niggers. White women are the forefront of that. Let's see. I thought it was really important as well, him talking about how black people and gender are viewed as feminine in relation to the masculine white race. Let's see where he says, as Jules Michelet writes, Africa is woman. Her races are feminine. Even I can pause right there when they talk about pulling out frequently when they're going in to invade these non-white areas frequently on the continent. Continuing, the designation of a race as feminine was not to suggest that the feminine race was in fact gendered, but that the feminine race held an inferior relation to the patriarchal Anglo-Saxon race and possessed a sensual connotation. I think that's really important because I think Mr. Demrefort talked about the terrorism is so frequently sexual. I think that's also something that we've emphasized over the past decade. Let's see. Yeah, he emphasized blacks were primitive and as such not yet evolved to the level of civilization necessary to warrant distinctions between men and women. As purely sensual beings, they had no reflective sensibilities that could grasp the purpose of gender roles, which was to ground civilization, much less the morality of femininity or burdens of masculinity, according to 19th century racial sciences. And I also think that that's extremely important, that he's grounding this in race, white supremacy science, that this is not just, you know, a few random folks out on a street corner or with one tooth or a few ignorant whites. That's one that they love to say, oh, it's just, you know, a few poor white people here and here down. No. This is coming from the academies, the ivory towers are handing this down. Some of the most noted ethnologists and scientists of the day are saying, oh, yeah, you know, the niggers are savage and primitive, and they're not even evolved enough to qualify as men and women. This is what the most prominent whites of the day are saying. And these folks are still revered in the Academy 2018. So it should not be surprising to anyone, Cal's listeners, folks who understand racism, that these notions are still extremely prevalent in how we're viewed, talked about, treated. Again, the sex and racism together When it says, for example, Franz I. Pruner Bay suggested that the black man is to the white man what woman is to man in general, a loving being and a being of pleasure. Saying the black man, not black people, not the black male and the black female, but the black man, a loving being and a being of pleasure to the white man. Wow, what an analogy. Let's see. I thought it was really important also, because a lot of this talks about it after the conclusion of slavery, that it was not an immediate black male launch into I'm going to be a patriarch and dominate females. It was black males are not thought of as being men capable of participating in patriarchy. They need to be castrated and lynched to control their feverish nature. He writes, being the African male was thought to be irrational and barbarous. He was not a patriarch and therefore unfit to rule or govern himself. The black male was thought of as a thing that is to be ruled. He could not be improved through education or religion because his sexual instincts overwhelmed the higher faculties to which ethics or reason would appeal. Really important. And I'll even pause there. I did say something about this 2 weeks ago when we read the portion in the text where it talked about the black macho the myth Michelle Wallace, the black macho, where it says she painted the black man black. She maintained that black men had internalized the white man's obsession with his penis. As she said, white men were perversely obsessed with the black man's genitals, but the obsession turned out to be a communicable disease. And in the 60s, black men came down with high fevers. I said this when we covered that section in the introduction, and I'm repeating it this week after reading the portion that I just read in chapter, that was chapter one. This consistent emphasis that black males have some sort of that their sexual appetite just overwhelms their ability to think or reason or act in any sort of logical manner, being described where this sexual appetite just totally takes over beyond any sort of sane control, being described this way in this book. Michelle Wallace saying that in The Black Macho and in Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, black males being feverishly chasing white women. I think that's what I said when I mentioned that. Why I said that stuck out to me in the text was this is the way black males have been described for centuries under the system of white supremacy, this same type of languaging. And that's what we're supposed to be doing as attempted counter-racists, paying attention to the way that words are used, where you can see patterns, the same type of words, feverish and barbarous and overwhelmed by this, you know, sexual appetite, this type of language consistently being employed. It's all connect the black rapist. There's a reason we got to do all this. There's a reason we got to hack off his penis and put it in a mason jar, put his testicles in a jar, or make him eat it. There's a reason we got to do all this. He's feverish. Just making that point once again. I will pause there. Did we have any other folks who had commentary that they wanted to get to before we get to audio segment number two? We have about 5 minutes.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
This is just another passage in page 48, where, and I think this is really important. This is more of on a global sense, and it states the white home of the 1860s forward not only was used to gauge the civilization of all other races, but also necessary to the settler project itself. Like, it almost is.
Are you with us, sir?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, we lost your audio for a few seconds there. It's almost like, and then the audio went out.
Oh, apologies. Basically, almost stating like this, this is basically the crux. This is how everywhere on the globe should be in relation to them. And it's putting them already at the pinnacle of what civilization is in the 1860s. I mean, if your household wasn't reflective of theirs and what masculinity and femininity was, basically saying that it was probably lesser. And that's what a lot of this text is coming down to in that passage. But I just wanted to get that point across, and I'll mute my line.
Thomas in New York, did you have a comment as well, sir?
Yes, I did. I just wanted to say, just to expound upon the roles of the white women, and even in this book, to answer your first question as well, it goes in line, whereas in a patriarchal society, and you have black men or black males with white women with more authority and power than them, then they're not allowed to be men. They're only going to be males. And I think the same thing falls in line for women. Because as he explained in the book, the household became the matriarchy, where she had the authority. And if in the household, the black female doesn't have more power than the white child. You know, she's not allowed to be a woman either. So I think it falls in line with the question that you asked.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. Did anybody else have question, comment, anything they needed to share before we briefly before we get to the second audio segment?
Yes, may I be heard?
Mr. Demery Four?
Yes. Gus, I just wanted to bring attention to I believe the book was saying that at the turn of the century, a physician William Lee Howard believed they were studying the soldiers nude, and they were trying to determine or ascertain the masculine attributes. And I thought that was interesting, that that was probably, you know, if you think about white people owning slaves, they would know, you know, how the physiques of the black people were, but those that hadn't come in contact with them. So then to study the black males, you know, nude like that. And, you know, it just seems so sexual, you know, I guess homoerotic. I'll mute my line.
Well said, Mr. Demery Four. We will end there and get to the second audio segment. We're still in Chapter 1. This is Dr. Tommy Curry, The Man Not, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number 2. The Sexual Inversion, The Primal Rapist as Feminism's Foundational Ethnology. The white woman was an essential component of the colonial endeavor. Her presence in the colony not only accentuated racial and gendered lines, but also determined the spatial arrangement of the geography she occupied. Whereas anthropologists such as Anne L. Stoller have shown that European women were not only the bearers of racist beliefs, but hardline operatives who put them in place, fostering new racial antagonisms formerly muted by sexual access, the position and power of white women in the American colony has not been thoroughly explored. This is not to overlook the work by historians such as Alison Snyder, Margaret Jacobs, and Louise Newman, who have established that the quest for women's rights and what is generally understood as feminism is more properly understood as a complement to the imperial patriarchal endeavor rather than a challenge to it. Early women's rights activists' arguments against disenfranchisement and patriarchy insisted that white women were effective civilizers every bit the equal of white men because of a shared evolutionary history. From Elizabeth Cady Stanton to Charlotte Gilman, there was an insistence that the white woman's burden entitled her to rule alongside white men at home, as in the case of the ballot, or abroad as the colonizer. From this historical viewing of white women's relation to natives and blacks, feminism is patriarchy, or more accurately, its perfection. Despite these literatures, this history of white women's violence and gendered racial dominance has had little effect on disciplinary conceptualizations of white women's rights or the gendered power white women had over black men after emancipation. The vulnerability the white woman exhibited toward the racialized male other established her moral superiority to the savage brute who would threaten her piety. The anthropologist Abu Ali Farman Farmeon writes that white womanhood could only be, and indeed was, sanctified in contrast to a transgressive other, namely the native rapist and the promiscuous native woman. Within this context, white women established themselves as racially, hence morally and intellectually, superior to newly enfranchised black men by perpetuating the idea that their virtuous womanhood was, in fact, the target of his savagery. Created as vulnerable to the black rapist, the white woman was able to justify all sorts of punitive sexual acts against free black men that indicated not only that they were unfit for freedom in the Republic, but also that their demise was necessary for the entrance of white women into the public square of governance. Suffragettes used their position within patriarchy as civilized, masculine white women to enforce violence and death against the newly enfranchised, barbarous male. In this political contest, the entrance of the white woman into the perilous public from the protected home required white men to make the political space safe, or to execute the white woman's primary social threat, the black male rapist. In America, lynching was the violence of choice. Lynching for the crime of rape was a political and racial rallying point for white men and white women. In a similar vein, Grace Elizabeth Hale observes that lynching was not only about the emasculation of black males, but also about the masculinization of white women. Lynching empowered white women to stand above the now unsexed, castrated black male as a patriarch and more manlike master who has conquered the savage black male beast. Explaining the participation of white women in lynching, Hale writes, "White women often participated as announcers of the upcoming event, as spectators, and as gatherers of wood and other fuel. They directed the actions of large numbers of white men by alleging rape, attempted rape, or even an attempted stare, and by demanding tortures and egging mobs on. In one case, a woman even stood on the car and yelled, 'Roast the nigger!' when it seemed the mob might show mercy. Not just the white man was empowered when the black man was literally and symbolically deprived of his masculinity. The lynching narrative moved white women towards masculinity, even as it subtly shifted white men away from maleness embodied in the black beast they were trying to capture through castration. Current theoretical practices suggest that the reach of patriarchy immobilized white women such that they were not perpetrators of violence, only blind to their whiteness and exclusive in the pursuit of their racial interests. Among theorists, white women are imagined throughout history as passive and inactive, absent from history and thereby absolved of the violence committed against blacks throughout history. Consequently, the violence white women committed against black men, specifically their participation in lynching, has been thought not to exist. At the turn of the century, white women activists supported lynching and proliferated the black rapist mythology throughout feminist literature. The most ironic example is the feminist Rebecca Latimer Felton. She began her political career as an advocate for black women in the 1800s. She began her anti-rape activism on behalf of a 15-year-old black girl named Adeline Maddox, who was sentenced to 5 years of hard labor for stealing 50 cents. Felton found that the treatment of young black women in the convict lease system was horrifying. They were raped by the white guards, forced to have interracial children, and shackled day and night. By 1897, Felton's anti-rape activism had taken a decidedly anti-black turn. Instead of recognizing the connection the myth of the black rapist had to the Jezebel myths affecting black women, Felton embraced the criminalization and extralegal murder of black males. She wrote, "If it takes lynching to protect women's dearest possession from drunken, raving human beasts, then I say lynch 1,000 a week if it becomes necessary." This racist and misandrous ideology defined not only white perceptions of black men, but also public policy toward them. The rapist was a symbol of the race problem and an obstacle to white women's political power. In 1898, however, Charlotte Gilman argued in Women and Economics, a study of the economic relation between men and women as a factor of social evolution, for a concept of the black rapist as the birth of evil in the world. This exceedingly racist text begins with a poem that tells a creation story of humanity. Humanity begins with twofold man. Twofold man actually refers to both the primitive man and the primitive woman who lack gender distinctions because they are savage. Primitive man and his female were animals like other animals, Gilman explains. They were strong, fierce, lively beasts, and she was as nimble and ferocious as he, save for the added belligerence of the males in their sexual competition. Twofold man was born equal. They were comrades. Consciousness came to primal man and woman slowly. Through consciousness, they learned about pain and about pleasure, and he learned about woman. As they labored together in the forests, he learned about rape. He learned that he will never have her when he pleases. Gilman believed that the origin of woman's subjection and the sexual economic relationship was the development of the primitive rapist. Like the other woman of her time, Gilman equated the primitive man with the Negro male. She understood the meaning associated with black male sexuality and, like her predecessors, depicted him as anathema to white civilization and the white womanhood at the center of it. Gilman's text demonstrates that the idea of blacks as ungendered, savage, and primitive still formed the intellectual and progressive milieu of the 20th century. Even progressive feminists such as Jane Addams were convinced of the myth of the black rapist. In Respect for Law, Addams argued that Southern lynching often rises to unspeakable atrocities and is complicated by race animosity. Nonetheless, she wrote that brutality begets brutality, and proceeding from the theory that the Negro is undeveloped and therefore must be treated in this primitive fashion, it is to forget that the immature pay little attention to statements that quickly imitate all they see. The underdeveloped are never helped by such methods. The dawn of the 20th century birthed a feminist activism that used the myth of the black male rapist as a bridge between white women's moral capacities and a more visible political presence and engagement with societal problems. The black male was most often the problem feminists chose to address. While white women were framing women's rights as resistance against the primal Negro rapist, Archibald H. Grimke argued in The Sex Question and Race Segregation that white women were still actively raping and sexually assaulting black men throughout the South during Jim Crow. After describing how white men would seduce and rape the black woman, Grimke said, "But there is another aspect to this side of the subject which must not be entirely ignored, and that is the existence in a few instances of illicit relations between some white women and some colored men in the South. That such relations have existed in the past and do actually exist there at the present time, there is absolutely no doubt whatever." Grimke explains, "There have always been white women who have conducted secret sexual relationships with black men as a means of satisfying their lust. For it is a fact hardly less curious, if not so strange, that there are men who, while they would not think of marrying into a class beneath them, would nevertheless live readily enough in a state of concubinage with women of that class. And in this upper class, there are women, not many, it is true, who would do the same thing. They care enough for the men in the class beneath them to enter into licit relations with these same men in the open, in the gaze of a scornful and horrified world. Has it ever been seriously considered that like father may occasionally produce like daughter in the South? And that such moral lapses by a few white women of that section may be accounted for, in part at least, by that mysterious law of atavism? The sons are like their fathers in respect to their fondness for colored women. Why may not one daughter in, say, 10,000, resemble those fathers in that same shameful, though not altogether unnatural respect? Do not such instances, few and far between at present though they may be, furnish matter for thoughtful people of the South, regardless of sex, race, or color? It was well known that white women pursued and coerced black men into sexual relationships, but many insult to a white woman's advances as well as any surrender to her demands could be considered rape. The writings and activism of early feminists helped make the fear America had of the black rapist the dominant political ideology of Jim Crow. Through the symbolism of the black rapist, feminism garnered popular support in its narrative of white female vulnerability to rape. By casting the primitive black male as their natural enemy, feminists of the 19th century provided ideological fuel to the murderous lust white men expressed toward black male bodies. The primal rapist inverted the male-female hierarchy and confined black men to the modality of the slave even after emancipation. In other words, the myth of the black rapist allowed white women to exercise their sexual power over black men through illicit sexual relations and rape, and to further white men's justification to murder and lynch black men in an attempt to garner political power and deny political rights to blacks in the United States. Contrary to the distant and extricated position from which white womanhood is usually theorized, excluded from the formulation of racism and sexual violence, an attentive, historically informed theorization of black males illuminates the calculated efforts white women took to make their sexual vulnerability the rallying point of white supremacist violence against black people through the 19th century and early 20th century. History suggests that instead of simply competing within an American political field for rights, black men were, in fact, excluded from American politics by the violence specific to their sexual representations as black and male, an existence that permitted lynching, rape, and execution to prevent the black male's rise as a citizen in the American public.
They were all patriarchal, challenging the mimetic thesis given the status of the black home in racial uplift ideology. 25 years ago, Beverly Guy Sheftall published her doctoral dissertation as Daughters of Sorrow, Attitudes Toward Black Women, 1850 to 1925. Guy Sheftall's study was an attempt to explore the attitudes between 1880 and 1920 that have been frequently expressed about black women by whites, male, and female, and by black males. Gender is definitive in Guy Sheftall's work. She assigns convergence and divergence around the axis, noting the points at which these attitudes intersect and diverge, acknowledging that the scholarship on black male attitudes toward black women is woefully inadequate, especially for the period between 1880 and 1920. Guy Sheftall had to rely on the only two sources available at the time, Lawrence Freedman's The White Savage, Racial Fantasies in the Postbellum South, 1970, and Rosalind Terborg Penn's Black Male Perspectives on the 19th Century Black Woman, 1978. Freedman argues that black men were committed to Victorian standards of womanhood and the home. He writes, "Clearly, white, Southern, racist, and black activists looked at women in similar terms. Both viewed the female as a second sex with distinctly limited privileges. But the parallel ran even closer. Since antebellum days, Southern planters idolized the white woman as a jewel of the universe, adoring her in finery and speaking of her as a near goddess. By the turn of the century, as articulate Negro activists busied themselves on the racial front, many thought in the same terms. Both claimed guardianship over their women. Both elevated the female above the state of mortals. Southern males, white and black, were therefore participating in the dehumanization of womanhood. Hence, the effort to fortify racial pride through exaltation of pure womanhood was likely as disastrous for the black race as for the white." Following Freedman, Guy Sheftall argues that black men, like their white male counterparts, were reluctant to challenge accepted notions of true womanhood. And black men's commitment to the Victorian notions of womanhood inhibited black women from developing their full potential. Ultimately,
Guy Sheftall concludes that black men internalized some of the culture's notions about sex roles. Because they are male, black men believe that they should protect their women from the evils of the world, and that black women, because of their sex, should assume the major responsibility for the moral stature of the race. On this view, black men took on Victorian ideas of manhood and womanhood in an effort to establish the patriarchal order of whites among newly freed blacks. Bell Hooks extends Guy Sheftall's analysis by arguing, most 19th century black men were not advocating equal rights for women. They wanted to be recognized as men, as patriarchs, and could not assume this position if black women were not willing to conform to prevailing sexist gender norms. This exclusion was not solely political, but also intellectual, as many race men, such as W.E.B. Du Bois, failed to imagine black women as intellectuals and race leaders. Over the past several decades, these criticisms of 19th century black male thinkers have largely been accepted without question. The archaic gender norms of 19th century America generally offend the sensibilities of most 21st century scholars, so there has been an automatic condemnation of black male ideas that parallel what are thought to be white patriarchal norms. This disposition has moved from what was the actual state of gender in black communities in the 19th century to what scholars 200 years later may think about those arguments. This is to say that, given the popular acceptance of these criticisms, there is a surprising omission in Guy Sheftall's study and in such literature more generally concerning how black women thought of themselves in relation to the gender norms of their day. Did black women desire to be placed within the home and call for protection of black men? 19th century ethnology made the home the foundation of racial uplift ideology. It was a racial project that required racial manhood and ladylike womanhood to drive political progress. Although rarely acknowledged, evolution was endorsed by many, if not most, well-known black women thinkers as the scientific justification behind racial uplift. The historian Louise Newman explains, as the personal and political struggles of Anna Julia Cooper, Ida B. Wells, and Mary Church Terrell suggest, civilization, racial progress, and women's protection within the home were interconnected in ways that made it impossible for black women to repudiate altogether the prevailing ideologies of the cult of domesticity and true womanhood. Like their white counterparts, black women reformers also used evolutionist discourses of civilization to justify their own social activism. They asserted their duty to elevate and uplift the masses of black women, upholding the values of domesticity, chastity, temperance, and piety that the white middle classes considered to be evidence of a civilized race. The home was key to black Christian middle-class men and women in the 1880s. Anna Julia Cooper was one of the most adamant champions of establishing the home on traditional Victorian gender roles. In her essay, Womanhood, a Vital Element in the Regeneration and Progress of a Race, 1886, Cooper argues, the late Martin R. Delaney, who was an unadulterated black man, used to say, when honors of state fell upon him, that when he entered the Council of Kings, the black race entered with him, meaning, I suppose, that there was no discounting his race identity and attributing his achievements to some admixture of Saxon blood. But our present record of eminent men, when placed beside the actual status of the race in America today, proves that no man can represent the race, whatever the attainments of the individual may be, unless his home has moved on pari passu, he can never be regarded as identical with or representative of the whole. Not by pointing to sun-bathed mountaintops do we prove that Phoebus warms the valleys. We must point to homes, average homes, homes of the rank and file of horny-handed toiling men and women of the South, where the masses are, lighted and cheered by the good, the beautiful, and the true. Then, and not till then, will the whole plateau be lifted into the sunlight. Only the black woman can say, when and where I enter, in the quiet, undisputed dignity of my womanhood, without violence and without suing or special patronage, then and there the whole Negro race enters with me. Cooper is not arguing that, because of their race and sex identity, black women can usher in the race. Quite to the contrary, she is actually saying that the race can advance only on equal footing with the homes of the rank and file of the race. We must not look to the elite, sun-bathed mountaintops to see that the reason and truth of Apollo, Phoebus in his Latin naming, has reached the masses, the valleys below. The masses must be lifted up, because homes are reflective of the status held by the women of the race. Then women must be civilized to achieve true racial uplift. This is why Cooper insists that the average homes of working class men and women must be advanced pari passu, or on equal footing with the most exceptional of the race. In the 19th century, gender distinctions between men and women, the status of the home, and the condition of a race's women indicated a race's evolutionary stage. Cooper explicitly endorses such a view. Cooper begins womanhood by reflecting on the differences between the idea of the home in the United States and in countries of the East. She begins with so-called Oriental countries, which she claims have confined women to ignorance, infamy, and complete stagnation. She then moves to the Muslim. Cooper writes, Muhammad makes no account of woman whatever in his polity, because the Quran was a product and not a growth of Arab civilization, it paid no attention to the status of the home. As she writes, the Arab was a nomad. Home to him meant his present camping place. Cooper argues that it is the Muslim God who ordains such a view. Whereas the Christian God makes and sanctifies the home, Muhammad made the home a transient bauble to be toyed with so long as it gave pleasure, and then to be thrown aside for a new one. Cooper saves her most caustic remarks for the Turk. She quotes an unnamed writer stating, the private life of the Turk is the vilest of the vile, unprogressive, unambitious, and inconceivably low. While Turkey has produced great men and brilliant minds, men skilled in all the intricacies of diplomacy and statesmanship, men who could grapple with the deep problems of empire and manipulate the subtle agencies which checkmate kings, these minds were not the normal outgrowth of a healthy trunk. There is a worm at the core. The home life is impure. Cooper turns with pleasure to the examples of Europe and America from the effete and immobile civilizations of the East. While the Eastern nations are slowing, decaying, the West is synonymous with all that is progressive, elevating, and inspiring. On what basis does this hope for American civilization rest? Cooper asks. Can anyone doubt that it is chiefly on the home life and on the influence of good women in those homes? Cooper's question is not rhetorical. It conveys her view on the matter. Now, after our appeal to history, comparing nations destitute of this force and so destitute also of the principle of progress, which other nations among whom the influence of woman is prominent, coupled with a brisk, progressive, satisfying civilization, if in addition we find this strong presumptive evidence corroborated by reason and experience, we may conclude that these two equally varying concomitants are linked as cause and effect. In other words, that the position of women in society determines the vital elements of its regeneration and progress. Now that this is so on a priori grounds, all must admit, and this is not because woman is better or stronger or wiser than man, but from the nature of the case, because it is she who must first form the man by directing the earliest impulses of his character. Cooper demonstrates that it is not only black men who fundamentally believe it is the charge of the woman to dictate the morality of man. Cooper indicates that this fact is a priori, meaning that morality, character, is synonymous with the concept of the woman herself. The male may bring, as an exotic, a foreign graft, say of civilization, to a new people. But what then? Alexander Crummell's answer is womanhood. If you want the civilization of a people to reach the very best elements of their being, and then, having reached them, there to abide as an indigenous principle, you must imbue the womanhood of that people with all its elements and qualities. Any movement which passes by the female sex is an ephemeral thing. Without them, no true nationality, patriotism, religion, cultivation, family life, or true social status is a possibility. Like Crummell, Cooper understood that racial development is dependent on the status of the woman. She says that the position of woman in society determines the vital elements of its regeneration and progress. In fact, this view was widely held even among the black women social scientists of the late 1800s. In her keynote address at the Women's Meeting of the Atlanta Sociological Laboratory in 1897, Lucy Laney announced, "Motherhood, honored by our blessed master, is the crown of womanhood. This gives her not only interest in the home and society, but also authority. She should be interested in the welfare of her own and her neighbor's children. To woman has been committed the responsibility of making the laws of society, making environments for children. The making of the laws of society connoted the woman not as a singular subject, but as creator of society through the home. As Laney said, the chief joy of home is mother." Similarly, Olivia Davidson claimed, "We cannot too seriously consider the question of the moral uplifting of our women, for it is of national importance to us. It is with our women that the purity and safety of our families rest, and what the families are, the race will be." The historian Michelle Mitchell argues that reform activists who labored on behalf of the race were imbued with politicized missions to change the habits, environments, morals, and lives of African Americans. These activists took it upon themselves to convince their sisters and brothers that progressive individuals behaved in certain ways, that proper homes had strong patriarchs, pure mothers, and children schooled in race pride. Contrary to the claims of Guy Sheftall and Hooks, patriarchy and established gender roles were an uplift program endorsed by both black men and women. Current black feminist historiography starts from an ahistorical claim that gender created difference between black men and women in the 19th century, while class, religious, and racial sentiments were similar. This a priori distinction between male and female gender is what grounds the opposition between 19th century black men and women, not their actual circumstance. For Cooper, no tension emerges between the manhood and womanhood of the race. In fact, they necessitate and depend on each other. The fundamental nature of womanhood was to develop in the race a patriarchal manhood capable of protecting the black woman and black home. The race is just 21 years removed from the conception and experience of chattel, just at the age of ruddy manhood, remarks Cooper. To make the race more masculine, civilized, mothers and the development of homes were fundamental. Cooper was clear on this point. A stream cannot rise higher than its source. The atmosphere of homes is no rarer and purer and sweeter than are the mothers in those homes. A race is but a total of families. The nation is the aggregate of its homes. As the whole is sum of all its parts, so the character of the parts will determine the characteristics of the whole. These are all axioms, and so evident that it seems gratuitous to remark it. To build homes, the race needs men to protect the ladylike character of the black woman. Black women need men who can let their interest and gallantry extend outside the circle of their aesthetic appreciation. Men who can be a father, a protector, a brother, a friend to every weak, struggling, unshielded girl. The black woman in the South needs chivalry regardless of her station. It is the protection of her honor and sexuality by black men from the lower classes of white men that the colored girl of the South needs. Cooper observes that the black girls in the South are often without a father or stronger brother to espouse their cause and defend their honor with his life's blood. As husband, as father, by name, Cooper calls for black men to take up their manhood to advance the cause of the race and womanhood. In calling for black men to protect, she is laying claim to a schema of racial advancement that demands the division of sex roles, gender, and the protection of weaker women. As the historian Glenda Gilmore observes, by admonishing men to fulfill their potentials, Cooper executed an end run around patriarchy. Ideal patriarchy should not limit women. It only did so when the man in question was stunted. In fact, men could take women's striving as a useful early warning sign to encourage them to exercise patriarchy more strenuously. If women were gaining in the race of life, men should run faster. The historian Crystal Feimster has argued that Cooper's call for the protection and elevation of black womanhood stressed both the advancement of British civilization and a Christian manhood that sought to honor and protect all women. Cooper called on black men to do their part to ensure the safety of black womanhood. Given the condemnation of 19th century patriarchy, Gilmore questions the legitimacy of the term, given what Cooper demands. Gilmore maintains that Cooper never addressed the problem that her reasoning created. That is, if patriarchy ceases to limit women, is it still patriarchy? By calling the hand of the patriarch. Following the evolutionist trends of the day resolves Gilmore's question, for Louise Newman argues that black women's desire for and advocacy of bourgeois respectability, which mandated conformity to the norms of patriarchy, was not so much evidence of their class conservatism, however, as it was of their commitment to taking responsibility for racial uplift. Is patriarchy oppressive when it is a demand of black women, or only when it is an aspiration of black men? Cooper describes Alexander Crummell's The Black Woman in the South as a work penned by Moses and the prophets. Cooper actually claims she owes her thinking about black womanhood to the correctness of Crummell's previous work. She writes, "Nor could it have been intended that I should apply the position, when taken and proven, to the needs and responsibility of the women of our race in the South. For it is not written, cursed is he that cometh after the king, and has not the king already preceded me in the black woman in the South? Despite the influence Cromwell's The Black Woman of the South had on Cooper's womanhood, it is Cooper's work alone that is thought to stand out as exceptional in its regard for black womanhood. Given that feminists praise Cooper's contributions to intersectionality and gender theory, it seems clear that Cromwell's maleness erases his reflection on black womanhood in favor of Cooper's, despite the essays making the same recommendations and assumptions concerning black womanhood. Cromwell recognized black women's precarious position. He writes, "The fine domesticities which give the charm to family life and which, by the refinement and delicacy of womanhood, preserve the civilization of nations, have not come to her. She has still the rude, coarse labor of men. Because the home life of the black woman was not secure and safe, it afforded her neither protection from white men nor the luxuries of feminine delicacies." Cromwell believed that Christian women of intelligence and piety, well trained in domestic economy, should go to the South to show and teach them the ways and habits of thrift, economy, neatness, and order, to gather them into mothers' meetings and sewing schools, and by both lectures and talks, guide these women and their daughters into the modes and habits of clean and orderly housekeeping. He calls for a domestic revolution that extends racial uplift to the masses, a revolution raising up women to be the helpers of poor men, the rank and file of black society, all through the rural districts of the South. Cooper does not disagree. She is supportive of Christianizing the black women of the South. In fact, she insists that the idea of radical amelioration of womankind, reverence for women as woman, regardless of rank, wealth, or culture, was to come from that rich and bounteous fountain from which flow all our liberal and universal ideas, the gospel of Jesus Christ. The only difference in their proposals is the emphasis Cooper places on black male protection of black women as necessary to the thriving of the home. Despite these similarities, gender insists that an a priori opposition must exist between the sexes. Even when black men and women endorse the same idea, gender theory imposes difference and defect where black male endorsements of Victorian ideals are described as patriarchal and black female endorsements of the very same ideals are deemed progressive. Escaping savagery and ascending into the civilization modeled on white middle class values was thought to cultivate white respect for black humanity. It was widely believed that white society would be able to recognize civilization among the notable black classes regardless of race. This assumption was the grounding for much of the activism black intellectuals, journalists, and poets undertook in the late 1800s. Mitchell explains that concerns for sexual purity, child-rearing, habits of cleanliness and self-improvement enabled club women and race men to promote certain modes of behavior to instruct their brothers and sisters on how to attain a range of ideas. For black Americans who saw themselves as the best men and women of the race, there was a demand that their class, their distance from poor, uneducated blacks, convey the quality of their manhood and womanhood. Because class denoted intra-racial divisions, those who had elevated the upper class took responsibility for improving the uncivilized rank and file. Gilmore states, because of their own embrace of Victorian manners and morals, middle-class black men and women worried constantly about poor black people's public activities. Contrary to popular black feminist historiographies, racial uplift was a concerted effort between race men and women to create specialized gender roles within the race that required racial solidarity with black men rather than criticism of them, as well as acceptance of patriarchal authority. Racial uplift ideology had a missionary quality with regard to the rank and file. As Kevin K. Gaines argues in Uplifting Race, Black Leadership, Politics, and Culture in the 20th Century, racial uplift actually describes a black middle class ideology rather than a black middle class. Gaines continues, it was precisely as an argument for black humanity through evolutionary class differentiation that the black intelligentsia replicated the dehumanizing logic of racism. However problematic, the bourgeois cultural values that came to stand for intra-racial class differences, social purity, thrift, chastity, and the patriarchal family affirmed their sense of status and entitlement to citizenship. For the contemporary scholar, this means that the meanings commonly attached to gender or black patriarchy, masculinity, femininity, are, in fact, class ideologies, not the actual state of gender, which could only possibly be possessed by black elites among blacks in the 19th century. If these were debates occurring within aspiring black middle classes and imposed by the black middle class on the rank and file, what is the basis of the assertion that black men believed in sexual roles similar to those of white men? The current feminist historiography can be maintained only if the histories of the poor laboring class of black folks in the 19th century are made irrelevant to theory. It has become common practice to emphasize the gender differences between subjects and bodies, especially with regard to male bodies. However, class position and class aspiration remain unexamined to the scholar. Cromell is readily seen as male, but the shared middle class aspirations between him and Cooper are invisible.
And that is where we will conclude for this week. We are still in chapter one, getting close to the end. Next week, we will pick up on the black man's burden, black male resistance, and the mother right. That's for next Thursday. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in, if you have commentary to share, especially if you did not get to share during the first audio segment, you should dial in now, *61 to get your hand up. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free to share. Nothing stood out from second audio segment. Folks waiting to get their notes together. I will share a note or two while folks are waiting. If nothing stood out, I would find that shocking. Let's see. From the second portion, where he says, from Elizabeth Cady Stanton to Charlotte Gilman, there was an insistence that the white woman's burden entitled her to rule alongside white men at home, as in the case of the ballot, or abroad as the colonizer. From this historical viewing of white women's relation to natives and blacks, feminism is patriarchy, or more accurately, its perfection. Very important sentence, I thought. It reminded me of refinement in terms of white women being in agreement with, in occurrence with, the exact same white supremacist, white terrorist objectives that people almost instinctively associate with white men, but it is not recognized that white women have the exact same allegiance. That's why I said more accurately, it's perfection in my view. That is, I think that's the way Mr. Fuller describes refinement. Let's see. Next. Where he says, Grace Elizabeth Hale, one, she was a guest on The Cows. Two, where he says, lynching, suspected racist also, lynching for the crime of rape was a political and racial rallying point for white men and white women. In a similar vein, Grace Elizabeth Hale observes that lynching was not only about the emasculation of black males, but also about the masculinization of white women. Lynching empowered white women to stand above the now unsexed, castrated black male as a patriarch and more man-like master who has conquered the savage black male beast. I'm not going to read the whole portion. I just want to cut to the portion he quotes her. She says, the lynching narrative moved white women towards masculinity, even as it subtly shifted white men away from maleness embodied in the black beast that they were trying to capture through castration. I wish I had asked her about that sentence when we had her on the program. What do folks think about that sentence? I do see we had a hand or two, but just as folks are spectating, I'll read that sentence again. The lynching narrative moved white women towards masculinity, even as it subtly shifted white men away from maleness embodied in the black beast that they were trying to capture through castration. The portion I'm especially intrigued by, moving the white men, shifting the white men away from maleness. What do we make of that, particularly talking about in the context of a lynching and castration of a black male? Is that moving white men away from maleness? Let's see. The person 3098, did you have commentary that you wanted to add?
Yes, good evening, Chris. How are you? How's everybody today? I hope everybody's being constructive. A couple of things. I want to answer the question regarding from the first segment, conceptualizing the black male as children. I'm wondering, does Dr. Curry have a particular feeling, or have you spoke with him about his feelings about Mr. Fuller's or Dr. Cresswell's theories?
I know he has been asked about his thoughts on Dr. Welsing's work over the years. I'm not sure about Mr. Fuller. Dr. Welsing, yes, he has. That's in the archives. Mr. Fuller, I'm not sure.
The people ask, well, he seems to coincide quite nicely with both of their theories. And the question you asked about why you say that Mr. Fuller suggest that we refer to black males and black females as such rather than black men and black women. He seems to lay out a very convincing argument as to why this is so. So I'm very curious to whether you say, I'll check the archives to go back to check that, but it's very fascinating. The facial hair thing, it stuck out to me. I've been in and out today, so I'll have to go back and sit and write more about it, because I find it fascinating, like, that, you know, the facial hair aspect, it seems that I have to think about it. I have to think more about it, but it really did stick out to me for some reason, especially in terms of nowadays where most black males are sporting full beards. It's a very fascinating thing. I have to explore it more. Some other stuff. I wanted to know if you were interested. I found another podcast that Dr. Curry spoke on. I wonder if you were interested to hear it. I can send it to you, email it to you if you were interested in hearing it. And actually spoke to something from, I think, last week. We were speaking about rappers and their vulnerability. So I wanted to know if you were interested in hearing that. And maybe, like I said, it might be something interesting to include in the future broadcast.
Oh, sure.
With that, I'll mute my line. I'll mute my line at that point, and I'll continue listening. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing, and certainly thanks for thinking of us. You can, if you want to email it along, untiljustice@gmail.com. Much obliged. Other folks who dialed in, if we've not heard from you at all, the caller at 5771, if you have commentary, you should be with us.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus, and greetings to all the callers and the listeners. Wanted to share, didn't get a chance to do the first segment, but on page 54, it says in the first paragraph, last sentence, it says the black African male was identified as an abuser of the primitive woman, and colonialism was rationalized as an attempt to save her from her savage male counterpart. And I remember putting a note here in regards to noticing in commercials nowadays where you have these non-white black women with these white men posing as a family. And it kind of goes to the point that, you know, a black woman can't be part of a family unless she has a white male. So, it's psychologically, you know, telling us that, you know, no family is complete without some sort of white man, you know, especially a white man being the, you know, masculine or patriarch of the family. Page 55, it says within the context, the white woman established themselves as racially, hence morally and intellectually superior to newly enfranchised black men by perpetrating the idea that their virtuous womanhood was in fact the target of his savagery. Now, this kind of reminds me of the relationship of the white women and black male, the beginning of their interaction within the public schools, where especially schools where there are predominantly non-white black people in it, and especially non-white black males, and where it is dominated by particularly white women, which they start abusing and terrorizing black males early in their lives. So, you know, they subjugate the black males early, you know. So white women's domination of black males start in the public school system. So that kind of reminds me of that. And then on page 58, talks about, at the bottom it says, through the symbolism of the black rapist, feminism garnered popular support in his narrative of white female vulnerability to rape. I thought about Bill Cosby, and I thought about the Me Too movement, how, you know, they relate to each other, Cosby being the rapist, and then the rise of this Me Too movement would basically, you know, cater to, you know, the so-called vulnerability of white females in particular. So yeah, I thought about that. I think that's all I have right now. I'll mute my line.
Bill Cosby. the man not. They could have put Bill Cosby on. I'm going to ask Dr. Curry about that. He could have put Bill Cosby on the front cover of the book. He has George, young George Stinney, 14 years old, death penalty. South Carolina, the great state of South Carolina, is on the front cover, but it easily could have been Mr. Cosby. Others who dialed in have commentary that they wanted to share.
Yes, ma'am, Bureau.
Mr. Demery Four.
Yes. First, Grace Elizabeth Hale, that is a white woman that was on your on the show earlier. I mean, by her being a white female, that would make sense that she would say something like, you know, the lynching narrative move white women towards masculinity, even as it substantially shift white men away from maleness, embodying the black beast that they were trying to capture through castration. You know, it just kind of throws you off, because in the middle of these brilliant people like Ann, Julie Cooper, and Michelle Wallace, you know, then he quotes, you know, this suspected racist. I really don't know what to say about that, but I know that if it's possible for her to practice racism, then she probably was doing it when she wrote that. what I really wanted to talk about was, you know, the fact that maybe it's a question. I have a question. Okay, so if in a position of authority, if you use that position to manipulate and to terrorize or oppress some individual into a sexual act, then that's considered rape. And then so it's a fact that white women have been known to coerce and use their position to solicit black men in sexual relations, you know, that would constitute rape, I think. But that would be contrary to, I believe, what Dr. Francis Cress Welsing used to say, that if a female had a gun and she told a male to, you know, get it up, then it wouldn't happen because of the fear, you know. So it's difficult for the female to initiate rape. So that's just, you know, something to ponder. But Ms. Cooper, you know, I think it was interesting, you know, that these people were writing in the 1800s. And although she had this Victorian view and a Christian type view, she had a lot of valid points on building, you know, that, I guess, that empire building or the home front. And so she thought it was important for black men to protect black women, which brings up a point that we know that black men can't even protect themselves, but then it's a good philosophy. And then I noticed on YouTube there was a video where a black man in Florida used a gun to protect a black woman, pregnant black woman, from a white man that was attacking her. And it was lauded as, you know, something that black men should do more of in initiating protection towards black females. But I'll mute my line on that, Gus. Thanks for taking the call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have any comments, questions you would like to share, feel free.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter in Florida.
Yes, I just wanted to comment for a little while on the actual cover of the book. I think you mentioned the name of the black male who was on the cover, a child by the name of, I think his last name was Skinny. Kenny?
Stinny?
Yes. I did some reading and came across some components of his actual execution. Somewhere during the process, as he was walking to the electric chair chamber, he had a Bible in his hand. From my study, he was under 5 feet tall and somewhere around 100 pounds or maybe less or a little bit more than 100 pounds, you know, very small person, and would be considered to be a child. When he got into the electric chair, he was reportedly too short for the head attachment that's on electric chairs to be able to attach. Guess what they used to boost him up higher in the seat? The book that he had in his hand. It was a Bible. That's what they used with this child to kill this child. And I always thought that was, it describes white people to me, describes white people and their diabolical negative interests towards just about anything that has life in it. Not even just non-white people, but just anything that has life in it. What they actually have a disappreciation for. And that's why I think it's a good choice that he made to put that child on the cover of the book. Although I wouldn't have it a problem with the other option that you stated. But I definitely don't have a problem with the example that he put on the cover of the book. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Incidentally, since Idris Elba was mentioned, he was in a movie, No Good Deed. I just recalled it because it came up on the program. But talk about Black Miss Angie. Taraji P. Henson is in it. I think it came out in 2015. But he's a convict. Gets out, terrorizes a bunch of people. Total, everything that we've talked about right here. The black rapist. The sexiest man alive. And if you're going to get a movie role, you're still going to be black rapist. Any other folks have commentary that they wanted to get in? Last few minutes of the broadcast. Make sure I didn't miss out any other notes that I had from the final portion of the text. Even to Mr. Demery Four's point, the suspected racist female and her paragraph or sentence or two about the lynching and castration of a black male shifting white men away from maleness. Even if she was practicing racism, which she very may have been doing in that bit of writing, Dr. Curry included it. And, you know, he edited and had people to review. So that means that him reading it, it stood out for a reason to include it within, you know, the text of what he's doing here. So that means it had to resonate to him as well. Yeah, maybe that's one I will ask. Maybe we can get him back, or I can write him one and see why he included that within the text, because I don't recall him expounding on that, how white males were shifted away from maleness, although I do know that there is more coming on the homoeroticism of white supremacy, but more to come. Let's see. Anything else stood out from the second point? I do think it's really important, not only the notion that victims of racism, white supremacy, were not thought of as having a separate gender. They were androgynous, so to speak. I also think it's really important the evidence he provides that black males and black females were subjected to the same conditioning and had a lot of the same ideas about their situation and what was the best way to move forward. I think that's even popular now, thinking as though black males and black females have some radically different way of thinking about or viewing the world. And frequently that's not the case at all. It doesn't mean that they're identical, but I think we have been led to believe frequently that there are greater gender differences in how we think than there actually are. That's not saying that there isn't a difference between males and females, and certainly there is, but the system of racism, white supremacy, and the conditioning that whites put out on a global basis, that tends to get applied pretty uniformly to all of the Negroes. Could be an error.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Just the commentary. It's actually on the same. I think it's page 56. It's dealing with the lower bottom, where, and this is something that I mean, I really like to hear. I mean, Dr. Curry speaks about it sometimes, but he doesn't really go in depth, and I understand. The passage wrote, current theoretical practices suggest that the reach of patriarchy immobilized white women such that they were not perpetuators of violence or blind to their whiteness and exclusive in the pursuit of their racial interest. And then at the bottom, I'm going to jump to the bottom. It says, consequently, the violence of white women committed against black men, specifically their participation in lynching, has been thought not to exist. And I think that right there is so critical, how they found ways to almost cover up this history totally, where we have black feminists who will side with women suffragists and quote them, but not know the true history in regards to this. And I think that again, going back to Dr. Curry, like, I don't know how he does it in academia, where there are so many white female professors, like, and with the stance that he has, what he probably has to endure and deal with, I don't even know how he's able to do it. And I give him a lot of credit on that, because this whole book is just basically exposing the fact that we may look at, again, we keep looking at white man, but it's white man, white woman, and white child. And a lot of it is, the truth is the white woman is the pillar in regards to that. She is the one that sets everything off and puts all the gears in motion, so to speak, for lack of a better analogy. So I'd be curious to hear his opinion on that. That being said, I'll mute my line. Thank you.
I think if folks hear the broadcast with Melissa K. Stein, who was quoted in chapter one that we heard this week, she was a guest on The Cows in 2016. Dr. Curry submitted about five or six questions in advance of her coming on the program, and I was able to get them all in. And that was one of the questions that he asked. This and the way I believe that he talked about it was a deliberate effort to obscure white women's role in lynching and terrorism against black people, black males specifically, a deliberate effort to take them out of the literature so that people do not think of them as being participants and sometimes leading the way in those campaigns of terrorism. She responded, I remember, to that question in detail. We spent quite a bit of time on that. And I think even he addressed that specifically on one of his, the visit directly before Melissa K. Stein came on the program, which was spring of 2016. But yeah, we talked about that in detail. Very important, not minimizing the role of white women. That is 3 hours. We will be here next week as we continue the Man Knot, Dr. Tommy J. Curry. And again, if you have questions, archives, if you're listening or what have you, you can email. I have a list. We can keep our list as we proceed. I'm going to ask him about that quote about shifting white male or shifting white men away from maleness. I'm going to ask him about that. But he knows we're listening. So if you have a question or if you don't understand something or think something is not clear or whatever, we can ask. I'm sure he would be more than willing to give us an answer. We'll be here tomorrow. Neutralizing Workplace Racism, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Getting slowly adjusted to the old switcheroo. Saturday, compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what went down this here week. Much obliged for everyone tuning in to the program. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Thursday evening. Still trying to get the iTunes feed corrected, but we are current at Black Talk Radio Network, SoundCloud, Google Play, YouTube, courtesy of Mr. Fox. Lots of ways to access the context of white supremacy. Let me know via email if you have any difficulties. With that, again, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Let's keep our brains functioning optimally so that we can crank out solutions to the problem, the system of white supremacy. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up each and every time we are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
No problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.